Hi, you're listening to the Pitch Vision My Cricket Coach Show, and you can find us at pitchvision.com. My name's David Hinchliffe in the UK.
And I'm Kevin Sampath from Australia. Coming up on the show, we have a look at five questions with Rob Armand, the strength and conditioning coach at Glamorgan. And we also have a chat to Ian Pont with his question of the week. And we also answer your questions. Well, David, it's been getting pretty cold up here, but I've managed to get into the nets a few times. Yep. And I've been working on my bowling recently. I don't know if you read Ian Pont's book, The Fast Bowler's Bible.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's just golden. Anyway, I've gone back to that, had a look at a few of the basics that I've been missing in my game, because I've felt I've just been running into the bowler's crease and chucking myself at the batsman recently without any technique.
Right.
So I just tried to change a few things, sort of getting my left side, which is my non-bowling side, out of the way when bowling. So getting my non-bowling arm really working and getting out of the way. And also my hip movement, so getting my hip to drive through as well. So yes, I've seen a lot of results, and people have been facing have been impressed. They think I'm trying to chuck or something, but I keep telling them it's Ian Pont's book and just trying new things here and there.
So it's making a difference to your pace then?
Yeah, it's making a great amount of difference. And the funny thing is, as Ian Pont says, once you try and get faster, you're not going to lose any accuracy. And that's what I found. Because I didn't used to be that wayward in the recent months. And I found I've been able to maintain my accuracy by increasing my pace. So it's been pretty good. It's good signs at the moment. I just have to start getting fit again.
Right, okay. So just for people who are listening who aren't familiar with Ian Pont, either the book or the Pitch Vision Academy course that he's done, when you say getting your non-bowling side out of the way, what do you mean by that? What are you actually doing?
Well, what I'm doing is whenever I used to run in, my non-bowling side used to be sort of in the way with my bowling side. So my left arm, which is my non-bowling arm, used to be in the way of my right arm. So my right arm really couldn't follow through with the full motion. And my left arm used to be in the way, therefore hampering pace. But what I've done is sort of getting my left arm out of the way, so really driving my right arm through and sort of twisting your hip, not really twisting your hip, but sort of driving through so that your movement gets your left arm out of the way.
Right.
It's really hard to explain it, but if you watch the top bowlers, sort of Brett Lee, Ian Pont especially mentions in his book, you see he really gets his left side of the body out of the way so that his right side can fully come through with a lot of pace. And that's what I've been trying to do, and I've felt it's really worked.
So it's a matter, really, of not getting too side-on and getting your driving your left arm down and around as quickly as possible so it doesn't block you off. Is that what you're saying? Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So getting it down and sort of back and high as far as possible so your right arm can come in and go in the whole motion without anything interfering with it.
I'm with you. Okay, and the hip drive is a sort of continuation of that, isn't it? As the arm is, your front arm is coming down and around, your hip is going around as well, isn't it? And driving towards the target, and that's helping generate pace.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because Ian Pont talks about your whole body working in as a unit. Mm. So when your arms are moving in the right direction, your hips are bound to move in that same direction as well. So it's sort of making your whole body is one, whereas before I used to have my arm doing a separate thing, my hip doing a separate thing, and my legs doing a separate thing, which really slowed me down. So yeah, I've just changed a few things and it's worked.
Yeah, the timing of it is very important, isn't it? The timing of each movement, each part of the action is very important, isn't it, to get right. If you get one of those movements slightly out of sync, then everything that follows it is out of sync as well. So it's getting those two things together, isn't it?
Yeah, and even on last week's show, Ian Pont spoke about rhythm, and that's really timing as well. So
it's
all about getting your rhythm right and your coordination right as well, which really helps. But what about you, David? I've heard you've had good weather up there, been playing some cricket.
Yeah, we were lucky enough on Saturday to have a really lovely day. So we played, as you know, we play a 100-over game in our league. And the way that split is, you can have a maximum of 50 overs for your innings. So we won the toss. We batted first because it was a nice day, and we thought we'd get the runs on the board and then try and bowl them out. And we did okay. We lost some early wickets, unfortunately, but we had a middle order rally, including quite a big stand from two experienced chaps, and we were well on target for a score considerably over 200. But unfortunately, that partnership was broken, and then we had a little collapse, and I was batting down the order because I had a little something wrong with my eye. I had some redness or swelling around one of my eyes, so I wasn't really in the best of shape to be scoring lots of runs. So I went in at number 10, and we were struggling a bit. I mean, we had about 180 on the board, but we were the run rate was good, but we had lots of time to get some more runs, but unfortunately we didn't have any wickets left, because fairly quickly after I came in, another wicket fell and the last batsman came in to join me, and he was a bit of a filling guy, the type you get who aren't particularly brilliant. And so his job really was just to stay at one end, so we could carry on. So it was coming towards the end of the innings anyway, and I really had two options open to me. I thought to myself, which one shall I do? So it'd be interesting to know which one you'd have done in this situation. So you were out of the two batsmen, you're the recognised batsman. We had a decent score on the board, but not a big score. And we had about five, I think it was about 5 or 6 overs left, something in that region. Now, the option number one that I considered was to go for it, just really start smashing it all over the place and try not to get out, try and get as many runs as possible before the guy at the other end got out. That was one option. Second option was to play a bit more sensibly, knock the ball around, keep the strike, pick up runs where you can, and wait until the last over to really go for the big shots, because every over that you take up batting means that they have one less over to get the runs because of the way that it's
That's right.
split. So the approach that I decided was to play sensibly, defend the good balls. If anything, any bad balls came, try and hit those. Any long hops or half volleys, try and hit those, but play sensibly and rotate the strike. That's the approach. Well, not rotate the strike, keep the strike, I should say. That's the approach I took, and we ended up with about, I can't remember exactly what it was. I think it was about 210, something like that. And I was
That's
not
pretty
out at the
good.
end, 20 odd, not out at the end. So, and the other
It's
chap
pretty
was not
good.
out as well. So which approach would you have taken, Kev? Do you think you'd have gone for the gone for the glory and tried to rack up a big score, or would you have done what I did and try and be a bit more sensible and hope that the chap at the other end didn't get out while you were sort of more accumulating?
Looking at your position in the order, David, I think you've done the right thing. But because I usually come in last or nearly last, and I remember a game where I came out last, and there's another batsman who came out with me who was the more established batsman, and we both decided that he'd have the sort of role that you'd have, sort of knocking around and playing sensibly, whereas if I got on strike, I'd try and hit the big ones. So even if I get out, I've tried trying. Because I'm a tailender. Because even if I try and block, I'll get out. So that with that sort of approach, we sort of played the game. So I think it really depends on the batsman. So because if I go out, I can't really block around for a while. So I have to play big.
All right, so you would have gone big anyway.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it was interesting because I came off, and a couple of the chaps just said to me, "Oh, what were you doing? What were you doing playing like that for?" And I thought to myself, "Well, that was the tact. I wasn't just doing it just for the sake of having not out at the end. I was actually trying to think about it, and it. But as it turned out, they did decided not to go for the runs because in our games you can have a draw. They decided not to go for the runs. They batted out their 50 overs. They were 9 down. They batted out their 50 overs for less than 100. So, as it turned out, maybe it would have been better if I'd have gone for it. Maybe hit a couple of fours and then got out, and then maybe we'd have had about, I don't know, 100 190 maybe, something in that region. So yeah. 20 runs less,
yeah.
But maybe four overs more to bowl at them.
But you can always look at situations in hindsight.
Mm, yeah, exactly.
But I reckon it's better safe than sorry, because if you gave them that chance and if they did take away the game, then you'd feel guilty as well.
Yeah, true. And the captain left it up to me to decide what to do. He didn't, as I walked out, he said, you know, have a look. He said to me, have a look, play yourself in. So, you know, I took that as well, you know, just play sensibly, really. So if,
yeah.
And I kept checking, you know, kept looking over to the captain to make sure that he wasn't, you know, signalling to me to start whacking it. Yeah. And then I went for it in the last over. So, you know, because I knew then in the last over, even if I got out, they wouldn't have any extra overs. So that was my tactic.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, it was interesting to be in that situation, because I'm rarely in a situation where I have to decide. You know, normally it's, especially if you're batting down the order, you know what it's like. Normally it's block it out for the draw or go for glory and try and win it.
How are your nerves then, David? Did you struggle coming up with a decision?
When you're out, that's the thing, you know. You're nervous before you're going out to bat, always, I think.
Yeah.
But when you're actually out there,
yeah,
the nerves sort of tend to go after the first. I mean, the first ball, you know, you always think, oh gosh, you know, I think everyone thinks that, don't they?
Yeah.
But then after you get the first ball out of the way, and you think to yourself, well, this bowling isn't, you know, particularly demonic. You know, no one's going to knock my head off or spin me out of the game or anything like that. So
yeah.
You sort of lose your nerves then, and you think, and then you start thinking, okay, just play each ball, play sensibly, and decide your tactic, and then play in that way. And I did, and I didn't.
Yeah.
To be fair, I didn't look like getting out. I don't think I think I hit a couple in the air, but always into gap. Always made sure that I was hitting into gaps. So, other than that,
yeah.
You know, I didn't look particularly. Like, I didn't play and miss at anything. But I mean, not saying I'm an amazing batsman. It was a pretty good track, and yeah, it was pretty average bowling, to be honest. But I enjoyed having to make some tactical decisions while I was out there. Yeah, and it's amazing. You're right. Even though you've got a sore eye, it doesn't feel sore when you're actually in the middle of battle. It's funny. Then as soon as you walk off, you're like, oh, my eye really does hurt.
I have a theory, actually. I reckon players play their best when they don't expect to play well. Because I remember my best batting innings was when I wasn't meant to play the game, because I was feeling pretty crook. But my captain said, come on, mate, we're going to be short if you don't play. So I came out as the last batsman, and I batted the best I've ever batted. I don't know what kind of theory that is, but my mates who play sports like basketball, they have the same theory as well. So,
I agree. Yeah, the pressure's off. Yeah, the pressure's off, isn't it? You know, if you think, oh, well, you know, if I fail, I've got a handy reason that I failed. You know, I'm not feeling very well or whatever. Then it doesn't, the pressure's off then, isn't it? And you can play with freedom. So I think that's probably what it is. You know, you want to, if you can recreate that when the pressure's off, then that make you probably 10 times better a player. If you're in the middle of a high pressure situation and you're just thinking to yourself, oh, well, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, I should try that.
Yeah. You've got to believe it, though. You've got to believe it. That's the problem. It's no good saying it. You've got to believe it.
Yeah. All right. We've got our 5 questions this week with Rob Arman. He's a strength and conditioning coach at Glamorgan. So let's have a look at what he has to say.
Oh, I just want to say before we play the recording of this that we recorded this as an impromptu recording at the last second while I was at Glamorgan's ground to do some filming for Rob's course on Pitch Vision Academy. So the quality, the sound quality is not perfect. So just in case you're wondering why, I use the internal microphone on my computer, on my laptop to record it. So it's not perfect sound quality. It's recorded in his office. It was just a last second decision. Oh, Rob, while we're here, let's do a quick recording. He said no problem, and we just fired up the computer. So bear that in mind when you're listening. It's only a couple of minutes long, though. So if you're if you can't stand it, fast forward about 5 minutes. I'm here in the Swalex Stadium, Cardiff, and alongside me in his office with a lovely view of the pitch and the outfield is Rob Arman, the strength and conditioning coach for Glamorgan County Cricket Club. Rob, what's a typical day like for you?
My day normally starts about 6:30. The alarm goes off. Take myself to the gym. I start training myself about 7 o'clock.
Yeah.
These are game days. Bear in mind, because I don't really get a chance to train during the game or after the game.
Yeah,
so
yeah, of course. Yeah.
Tend to get my training done first thing. So I'll head off to the gym, train for an hour, depending on what I'm doing for the day. Then I'll head to the club. Get to the club for around 8 o'clock. Have breakfast with the team.
Yeah.
We all eat together in the morning. And then the actual kind of day begins. Every day we go through a daily monitoring routine where the players are weighed, they check their hydration levels, and we also look at vertical jump scores every day, just to kind of monitor fatigue. Once the daily monitoring has been done, if the players require massage, I'm on hand to deliver any massages. Once the massage has been done, we tend to go out for warm-ups at 9:30 or 10 o'clock, depending on whether it's the first day of the game or the second, third or fourth day of the game. Once the warm-ups are done, tends to be about 10:30, kind of come back up to the change rooms, players get changed, and they head out first and start playing at 5 to 11.
Yeah.
That's pretty much where my involvement for game days finishes. Obviously, then lunchtime, you're on hand if anyone wants warm-up, if anyone wants massages at lunchtime, then you're on hand to deliver massages at lunchtime. And then probably the other part of the day, which is also quite important, is the end part of the day, recovery time. Obviously, with this cricket season being so long, so many games and kind of so many days back to back, recovery is vital. So as soon as the players come off the pitch, they're handed their own drinks bottle. And then in that drinks bottle, they've got water or Powerade, depending on what the personal preference is. They reweigh themselves, so they work out how much kind of fluid they've lost in the session. And then they replace that. Then food is brought in, so they're kind of rehydrating and kind of resupplying the key nutrients. And then they kind of go into the recovery side of it. So depending on who they are, they might want an ice bath, which they'll sit in the ice bath for anywhere from 1 to 15 minutes. Or they might have contrast showers where you kind of alternate between hot and cold water for between a minute and 2 minutes. And then they'll kind of pop their recovery tights on and kind of disappear off, ready for the next day.
When you are training the Glamorgan players, do you use different workouts for different disciplines, the batsmen, the bowlers, the wicketkeepers?
It's a tough question, but I'd probably say no. But there are slight differences between the three groups based on the individual physiological demands of wicket-keeping, batting and bowling. There's also slight differences based on, obviously, previous injury histories or injury profiles.
Yeah.
So as an overall answer, you'd say no, you wouldn't add or you wouldn't use different workouts. But yes, you would tailor certain parts of the workout to suit the specific demands of keeping, batting or bowling.
If you could go back 5 years and tell yourself something that you know now that you didn't know then, what would it be?
The first thing would be keep it simple. I think I overcomplicated things a lot 5 years ago, and I think my programming now kind of shows that. Second one would be intensity. I think intensity is a key to any kind of program, if a bad program or good program. I think if you go at it with a good level of intensity, you're going to get gains no matter how complicated or how simple the program. Periodization, I think, is key as well. That, again, looking back, that's something I probably didn't apply as much of as I should in my my early kind of years. And then the last thing would just be to keep on learning. So there's a wealth of information out there that nobody knows at all and probably never will do. So just keep learning.
What makes a good training atmosphere when you're training with a group of players?
For me, it's about creating the environment for them to succeed. You don't want to set up workouts that are too hard, or you don't want to set goals that are too far out of reach. So you have to kind of create an environment in which the players can actually succeed. Second thing would be enjoyment. I don't want them to see physical training sessions as punishment work. I want them to come in and enjoy them, but I also want them to work hard while they're there, so they're not coming in to mess about. They know that as soon as they kind of walk in the gym door, we'll have some fun, but Rob also requires 110% out of us. And then the last thing would just be goals. Make sure you set goals at regular occasions and review those goals, why they went, did you achieve them, if not, why not, and then just keep on reviewing.
Seeing as we look back 5 years, let's look forward 5 years for the last question. Where do you see yourself in 5 years' time?
I still see myself working within sport cricket, and ideally I'd like to see myself working with the national squad.
Right. Maybe. Yeah.
So I think that's my aspirations for the next 5 years, is to work in international cricket.
Well, fingers crossed with that. And Rob Armand, those are your five questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks Rob for your time. We have Ian Ponton on the line now with David.
Great to have you back on the show, Ian.
Thanks.
As 2020 is high on everyone's minds at the moment, what tactics can a bowler employ at the death of a one-day match when the conditions are unhelpful?
Right, well, let me firstly say that bowling at the death in 2020 cricket is always unhelpful in condition terms. I mean, I don't think that any fast bowler relishes running up and trying to get the ball as full as possible. But that's exactly what international players try to do, and any club players or juniors listening to this, the answer should always be, don't ever bowl a length at the end of an innings if a batsman's trying to hit you for six, mm-hmm. because you obviously don't want the batsman to be able to get underneath the ball. So if you bowl a good length delivery, which at the beginning of the innings was fantastic, mm-hmm. at the end of the innings, that's a complete disaster. So what you're trying to do is get the ball very full. You're trying to get underneath the bat, or you're trying to get around the bat, either side of it, and that would usually mean a change of speed. So, for example, you want the batsman just to have a big swish at fresh air and miss the ball completely, and that would be a change of speed. That could be quicker, but generally it tends to be slower. So practice some slower balls, mm-hmm. back-of-the-hand deliveries, split-finger deliveries, maybe knuckle balls, mixing up the grip a little bit. The secret of slower balls, of course, is to keep your arm speed looking exactly the same, and the ball just comes out a couple of yards slower and the batsman misses it. So the challenge, I guess, for people bowling at the death in unhelpful conditions, as we've mm-hmm. identified they are, is to try and get the ball full and straight, often outside off stumps, so the batsman can't drag you too much over mid-wicket, or right at the base of off stump. Even a low full toss sometimes is quite good. If the batsman's stepping away and clearing his leg to hit you over cow corner, you can sometimes mm-hmm. get it very full. But the big thing for me is variation, mixing things up a little bit. Don't get too samey at the end. If you're trying to bowl at the death, you don't want to be consistent in a way, because you don't want the batsman to be able to line himself up and think, yeah, I know what the next ball's going to be. It's the same as the other 10 he's bowled me already. So you kind of want to mix things up. Going full is probably the best way to go.
All right. Thanks, Ian, for your time. I think it's time we get into the questions, David. What do you reckon?
Yeah, let's go for it.
Welcome to the question section of the My Cricket Coach Show. Our first question is from Stuart, and he says, I've just fractured my cheekbone and I will miss a week or so. I have important games that I hope to play after about 2 weeks. What can I do to not lose my technique? Now, David, can someone really lose their technique, or is it form they lose? And fitness, so to speak. But can technique really be lost?
Yes, I think you put your finger on it there quite well. It's probably more about form and fitness than it is about, especially if it's just a short injury. I mean, I'm not an expert on injuries, but I would say that I don't know how long it takes a fractured cheekbone to heal, but I imagine it'd be more than 2 weeks. But anyway, let's put that out to the side for a second. Yeah, you definitely put your finger on it when you said form rather than technique, because once you've learned a technique, it's very hard to forget it. I mean, you have to spend a long time not playing cricket before you forget how to play the shots, even then they probably come back pretty quickly, I would imagine, because it's like, you know, it's what they say about riding a bike, you know, you never learn to forget how to ride a bike once you've learned. But it's very similar to, you know, once you've learned how to play a cover drive, you never really forget how to do it. So, yeah, he's not going to lose his technique in 2 weeks. But he might, as you say, lose form. And the problem with losing form is that no amount of time in the nets or practice is going to get it back again if you've gone with form.
Yeah.
So it may be that the rest will do you good and you come back into the game, and you're feeling this sort of new sense of freedom, and you're relaxed and you're confident, and you just go into the first game and start smashing it all around. That does happen sometimes. Or it may be that you go the other way, like we were talking about, you know, getting nervous. It maybe you get so nervous you can barely hold the bat, and you're all tensed up, and you can hardly play. So what I would say is, when you are past fit to play, go back to the simplest way you can in your technique. Play very sensibly, play very straight. Wait for your eye to get back in. You may find that the first time you try and drive the ball, it flies off the middle of the bat, and you think, well, this is easier. What was I worried about?
Yeah.
Or it may be that it'll take you an hour before you feel like you're getting anywhere near a reasonable level of form again. You know, you're playing and missing all the time. That happens. Just keep yourself at the crease. Yeah. Play the highest percentage shots that you can play, and play yourself back into form that way. That's the only way, really, you're going to do it. And if you get might get a Jaffa first ball and you nick it and off you go. Well, you know, that happens. There's nothing you can do about that. Just start again next week and keep going until you get yourself, play yourself back into form. It's the only way you're going to get back into form if you're out of it, is to play yourself back into it. In terms of fitness, you're probably not going to lose much in 2 weeks, to be honest. It depends what you're doing at the moment, training-wise. If you've got a fractured cheekbone, you can probably carry on training, at least, anyway, if you're doing any kind of fitness work.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you can get into the gym a couple of times, keep your fitness level up. If you can't get into the gym or you can't do any fitness training, then 2 weeks, it's not going to set you back very far. You'll catch that back up in no time. So, you know, you're not suddenly going to be a weakling if you're the size of Andrew Simons if you don't train for 2 weeks. Equally, you're not suddenly going to become Andrew Simons if you're 9 stone wet through, if you train for two weeks. So, you know, what I would say overall, I would say don't worry about it. Be sensible. Carry on doing as much as you can do. And then when you are past fit, take it as slowly as you need to get back into form.
Chris has a question, David, and he says he's struggling with laziness.
Mm.
And he says, my strength always used to be driving on the floor or over the top through cover or extra cover, but of late, perhaps due to the slow wickets due to the weather, I find myself staying back more than getting forward and looking to power the ball leg side for a big shot. I feel this is down to me being lazy and simply not getting forward and across to drive like I used to. Is there a recognized fix for this, please? And he also says that a couple of his juniors tend to do this as well, but it's probably because they don't have enough power to hit through the ball. Now, David, is this because he's not getting enough practice and the technique isn't sort of drilled into his mind, or is it really laziness?
Yeah, laziness is a funny way to describe it. Yeah, but I suppose it's lazy technique, in that he's using the bottom hand to try and power the shots rather than to control the shots and use timing to hit by using the top hand. You know, top hand control is what it's all about. That's why kids. But the natural thing is to hit across the line. You know, that's why kids, you give a 5-year-old a cricket bat and they try and smash everything to the leg side. Of course they do, because that's the natural inclination. Yeah. That's why we have to learn top hand control to be able to time the ball. So, it is a lazy technique in that way. So, yeah, he would need to do some practice to get out of that habit. And the way to practice is to get somebody to give him some throwdowns, you know, half volleys, so he can get back into the nature of controlling it with the top hand. The best way to do that is, rather than try and do the complete shot right from the beginning, is to just do drive with top hand to start with. Simple drill, you know, probably everybody's seen it, but do top hand drive. So take your bottom hand off the bat, put it behind your back, and do the drives with just the top hand, until you feel like your top hand is controlling the shot as much as possible. And then when you've done that for a while and you feel like the top hand is controlling the shot, then do top hand drills where you play the drive, you hold the shot at the top of the drive, and then you put your bottom hand in position at the top, and then you draw your bat backwards.
Yeah.
And then you do another one with both hands.
Yeah.
So you're getting the feel. You're getting the feel then with the bottom hand driving as well. The other thing is to get the weight forward, because what a lot of people do is they keep their weight back, and as he said, he tends to lean back a little bit or play back a little bit, he says, doesn't he? So what he needs to do is make sure he's getting his weight going in a forward direction. Doesn't necessarily mean you have to have a massive stride, but you have to have your head, which is the heaviest part of your body, you have to have your head moving forwards in order to get your weight going forwards.
Yeah.
So a good drill for that is to, when you're playing a drive, when you're getting some throwdowns, is to, as you're about to play the shot, lift your back foot up off the ground. And then your weight has to be forward, because otherwise you fall over. So lean right forwards, lift your back foot off the ground, play the drive, and then put the back foot back down again.
Just on the topic of the front hand and backhand, David, I've heard Gilchrist, and you probably heard of Gilchrist, using the squash ball in his glove to get front hand control and prevent this backhand being dominant. What do you think of that?
I mean, it worked for him, but I mean, I probably wouldn't recommend it for other people to do it. But it's a good thing to do, because it does give you a lighter bottom hand grip, which is important. But it's a bit gimmicky for me. I mean, you can learn the same thing without having to resort to cutting up squash balls, just by doing one hand drills.
Yeah. And what about the problem the juniors face? Can the juniors undertake the same drills as Chris?
Absolutely, no reason. I mean, we don't know how old they are, but there's no reason why you can't learn good technique from a fairly early age. So get doing those drills, get learning how to do it. Right. It may be, especially some of the smaller kids, that they're technically quite good, but they can't hardly hit the ball off the square. Well, I'd rather see someone like that than someone who is technically not so good, smashing it all over the place. Because by the time they're 16 or 17, they're going to be found out by better bowlers. Whereas if you've got a small kid who can defend well and play a few little drives and a few little hits off their legs to pick up a few runs, suddenly when they grow, when they turn 16, 17, 18, however old they are, then they get the power behind it as well, then they're going to be more likely to be successful.
This next question, David, from Megzi. They ask, I'm currently completing a grad cert in sports coaching and I need to design a tapering program. However, given the season at elite level is virtually year-round, what tapering approach is used? Do trimp scores get recorded for cricket? Now, I must admit, David, I have no idea what tapering is and what trimp scores are. So
okay.
you're on your own on this one.
Well, they're both training methods. Let's start with tapering. Tapering is a training method. It's a method of periodization. That's training over the period of a year or a certain amount of time, I should say. It's usually a year, but not always. It comes from endurance sports, and marathon running, things like that.
Yeah.
So if you've got a marathon coming up, then obviously you're running a lot of miles to train yourself for a marathon. But as you get closer and closer to the actual marathon, you don't want to be running like a 15-mile run the day before a marathon. So you use a method called tapering, where you taper off the amount of training you're doing in the 1 to 2 weeks before the big event. And it works for pretty much any sport where there's a big event. So Olympic sports, things like that, where there's a big event. So you taper off, you train very hard, and then as you get towards the date, you start to reduce the amount of volume, reduce the amount of training that you're doing until you're doing hardly anything just before, and then you do the big event and that improves the performance. Now, the problem, you can imagine what the problem is with cricket is that however you look at it, you either have no big events or you have a big event several times a week.
Yeah.
Depending on how you look at it. If you count a game as a big event, then it's, you know, you might, even club cricketers might be playing 3 or 4 games a week, possibly.
Yeah.
Even if you're just playing once a week, that's a hell of a lot more than, say, a marathon runner who might do. I'm not sure how many marathons a runner would do in a year, but I can't imagine they'd be doing more than 2 or 3 in a year.
Yeah.
Or, say, even like a 100-meter sprinter, at the top level, they wouldn't be doing many 100-meter sprints at the high competitive level very often. You know, they'll be doing sort of in between sprints, but you know, they'd be playing up to a big event like the Olympics or the Commonwealth Games or something like that. So you just simply can't use tapering in that way for cricket, because even if you're a club player, you're doing too much either too many of these big events or you never have any of these big events. Now, there's a slight a slight exception to that. Say, for example, if you are planning your season around one big thing, say, for example, in Australia, I know you have finals, don't you? So you could theoretically taper your training up and up to the start of the finals, so your peak when the finals start. Because the problem with that is that it doesn't really tie in with in-season training, because in-season training is more about maintenance, and if you're tapering off, you're not really maintaining, and if you're training hard, you could be overtraining, so it's a bit messy. So you can't really do it that way. So I suppose if you were an international cricketer, for example, and you were playing up to a big event like the World 2020, and you didn't have any and you didn't have any big competitive cricket before that, particularly. I don't know how Australia have a bit of a break before the World 2020?
I think they had a few weeks break.
So possibly they could have possibly done it, some kind of tapering there. But that's we're talking about a squad of 15 players, in the whole world who are going to have that kind of experience. And even then, you probably couldn't do it in the same way that a marathon runner would do it. So I wouldn't worry too much about tapering, generally speaking. It's not the done thing in terms of training. Now, trim scores are come from the endurance world as well. They're a way of working out a load on the body. So it's based on heart rate. So you monitor your heart rate while you're going for a run or swimming or bike riding or, you know, some endurance type thing. And then you see how long you did that particular thing for at that particular heart rate. And that gives you a TRIMP score. And that score then is the amount of load that your body has undergone. Obviously, then sort of the higher the heart rate and the more the time, the higher that number goes. So it allows you to compare, for example, a long run at a lower heart rate with a shorter run at a higher heart rate. And that'll give you, it should balance out, so you'll get the same TRIMP score if you get it right. But as you can imagine, all that is fairly irrelevant because, you know, cricket's an interval-based game. It's nothing to do with steady state training at all. I mean, heart rates go up and down all the time during a cricket match. Training-wise, heart rates go up and down all the time when you're training, when you're batting, when you're bowling, when you're fielding. So, as far as I know, I mean, I don't know everything about the professional game, but as far as I know, TRIMP scores are fairly irrelevant when it comes to cricket because it's an intermittent power-based sport rather than a long-distance endurance-based sport.
Okay, you guys can subscribe to us on iTunes, so pop us on your iPod and listen to the Micro Coach Show on the way to work or school.
Yeah, definitely.
And if you guys have any questions or feedback or anything, please email us at mycricketcoach@pitchvision.com. That's mycricketcoach@pitchvision.com. Thanks for listening, guys. From Australia, this is Kevin Sappat signing off.
And this is David Hinchliffe in the UK.
The My Cricket Coach Show is a copyright-protected production for Pitch Vision. For more information, please visit pitchvision.com.